You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, you are listening to the Orthodox Nationalist and its host, Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is being recorded on the 9th of December, 2023, Saturday. This morning, I lost my sister. We've been close as long as I can remember. So much of my eventual persona came from her influence. She's 9.5 years older than me. And she developed breast cancer, which then spread to the liver, the spine, and the brain very, very rapidly. Very rapidly, too. It was not expected, really, except the last week. I was roughly at 7:45 this morning. So, both to distract myself, as well as to make something positive out of this, I want to talk about, specifically, about death tonight and the remembrance thereof. It's rare that you come across in an Orthodox prayer service that doesn't mention that over and over again. We live in the regime does one of two things. Either it papers over death, just driving it from your mind so it becomes almost a hypothetical reality. We know what's going to happen, but we don't dwell on it, or obsesses with it. Things like the zombie phenomenon. Movies that have tens of thousands of casualties on screen. But for the most part, because the memory of our coming together, remembrance of death, is it's extremely sobering. The point is, we know we're going to die. We don't know when. And that brings us to repentance. So I went through my sources and have come up with a few excellent writings from the Orthodox point of view on this very phenomenon. Saint Ignatius Vinnychanenov, the 19th century, of course, Saint John Climacus, and the Archimandrite Raphael Karelin, who's alive today, last I checked, in Russia, because this is a universal phenomenon and central to the theology here. The way that the human mind is structured, either just inherently or because of our age, it's easy to push unpleasant things to the background. I always credited the fact that I was raised over my father's funeral home, that this has never really been a problem for me. I there was no way to shield me from death, even at a very young age. I was in cemeteries. You know, I worked there for years. It's my first job, even as a very young man. You can't shield me from that. I was in cemeteries, and dead bodies were always there, to the point where, because you're raised with it, it's never really a big deal. In other words, it was always in front of my face. But death, when it's someone that close to you, and especially if it's unexpected, you would have to be a retarded not to start to reflect on the phenomenon. Westerners, especially those amongst the oligarchy, are terrified of death. How many heart transplants did the late Rockefeller have? The cryogenics movement this bizarre promise of nanotechnological resurrection, quote unquote, is when you don't believe in God, the church, the afterlife, not God as some abstraction, but an actual personality, all you look forward to, at best, is death in the true sense of the word, just this frozen, eternal nothing. Death is, and this is very much by design, the aspects of death are kept hidden from us. When our death will come, where death will come, and then, of course, what awaits us beyond the grave. True piety comes from the realization that death and hence judgment can come at any time. It can come today. And again, this is especially the case when the death of someone you're close to comes very rapidly and very unexpectedly. My sister was in remission as of earlier this year, and yet the cancer overcame her a short time thereafter. Any day, this can happen. She was 61 years old. We talk about the repentance for sin, but there was no precision in terms of the defined time for it. If we knew when we were going to die, we would do entirely as we pleased, and then as that day approaches, we would do all of the ritualistic things that cleanse us. Now, that actually doesn't work, because that's a matter of calculation. But there's very good reason to keep these things hidden. The reason that it doesn't work, even if we did know, is that repentance comes from genuine desire. It can never be the result of calculation, this deception, as if God can be deceived. But the use of fantasy images that I've spoken of all the time as the end of our passions, one of the after effects, or one of the side effects of these, is forgetfulness of the nature of the world and death. We spoke of this a bit with Heidegger, although he wasn't this far from a religious philosophy. But the famous patristic quote is, if you have your own death ahead of you in view all the time, sinning becomes very, very difficult. So repentance could never be, you know, I'm getting old, therefore I better get cracking. It doesn't work that way. If the desire was genuine, you wouldn't wait that long. Even if that was somehow permissible, by the time the foreordained date would arrive, by that time, because you had done whatever you pleased up to that point, you would be incapable of repentance. Since it's not a habit, and in fact not done at all, it's like, you know, not using a muscle ever. Then when you go to use it, it isn't there. It can't function. So either the person would fall into just cold indifference or despair. And that's why, you know, death was introduced to the world, because sin couldn't perpetually replicate itself. But hiding the date, the million circumstances that it could happen, is hidden for that very reason. Death shows up without warning in many cases. It enters the house without knocking, as Raphael Carillon would say. It's a prisoner dragged into trial. We always sin. Avoiding it is more of an egotistical drive than anything else. To the extent we live in a phenomenal rather than a noumenal world, sin is built into the very structure of action. One of the important weapons we have is to keep death in front of us. But repentance isn't a matter of calculation. It's something that comes from grace itself. Commendrite Raphael has a three things that specifically he thinks push us away from the memory of death, considering death, thinking of our own mortality. And that's care, excessive care about the day-to-day, something he calls verbosity, and it comes in English, and mockery. Too much care, he says, is a waste of time. Constant work and constant worry about the day-to-day leads to man not remembering even himself. He's always doing, he doesn't have time to actually think on even the basic questions, which used to be central to people, but now are, they earn eye rolls more than anything else. Why are we here? Why are we on earth? A person who is loaded down with cares, and again, that's also from the egotistical drive to control everything, the belief that you have that capacity, and even if you did, it would just this nonstop work. And the last thing such a person will do is sit down and contemplate these basic ontological and theological questions. There's no place for God in that life. These things serve as distractions, and eventually you forget about death, and you don't see your own sins. The fathers have always stated, as long as the church exists, has existed, that one of the marks of spiritual progress is that sins that you never noticed before become sharp, stand out in sharp relief. And it gets to the point where even questions of theology are met with a wave of the hand. There's no practical dollar amount that you can put on such studies, or the humanities in general. These are these very pragmatic and practical people, and that's just another word for, you know, if it doesn't earn me something, if it doesn't earn me an income, then it's not worth it. They may be concerned with life on these largely imaginary distant galaxies. That's not a problem that he's told to think about. But as far as his own soul, that's a completely a separate matter. You know, the slackers or the dreamers, as he says, can deal with those things. But that's a trifling thing. This whirlpool of affairs, the constant bustle, especially in the city, it's almost as if he is hiding from God, and especially hiding from death. And all the more unexpected does death come. And he dies believing that he hasn't finished his work. Now, the concept of verbosity, this is the phenomenon. The Russian is, I had to translate this in a bunch of different ways. It's not just talking a lot. It's verbosity in ignorance. It's the loudmouth type. This is the second enemy of the remembrance of death. Someone who loves the sound of his own voice, which is a matter of hidden pride. Humility and meekness, as he says, are accompanied largely by silence. Words are, in fact, only a very small part of communication. And the Archimandrite says that this kind of loudmouthism, this pushy, verbose person, is almost like a drunk. It enslaves somebody. He becomes an appendage of his own language. The more that you're focused on these egotistical things, whether it be excessive care, not in Heidegger's sense, but or this constant pushiness, you're trying to manage everyone else's affairs. Again, it comes down to a matter of control. So much less time then can be spent on things that actually matter, because the things that actually matter don't usually earn you any money. To the extent that the external things are sought after, the greater your spiritual bankruptcy. So the loudmouth is really the thief of his own time as well as everyone else. I've never heard an Orthodox writer bring up this phenomenon before. It is maybe a modern phenomenon. I think it's been around a long time. But in the Middle Ages, of course, language was the vehicle of truth. It had no other purpose besides that. Now, you know, the nominalist mind doesn't believe in essence of anything. But the loudmouth, the verbose person, in his language, thinks that he knows everything. So it's not just someone who talks a lot or is loud. It's someone who talks about things. It's another word for it would be being opinionated. Being opinionated is not having a lot of opinions. It's having opinions on things that he has no right to have opinions on. It's this idea to control every conversation, giving unsolicited advice, which is usually always stupid. But because he thinks he knows all of this, is incapable. If you listen to my lecture on stupidity, which I did earlier this year, I think, the worst kind of ignorance, as Socrates would say, is the ignorance of your own ignorance. But that's exactly what the ignorance don't know. And that's why these people can have such overweening confidence with absolutely nothing to justify. Sometimes they speak because they've never learned to remain silent. Being silent means the only thing you have. I mean, being silent is not just not saying anything, but also not being surrounded by distractions. All you have are your own thoughts and memories, which I'm willing to say for the majority of people in the West is terrifying, because just maybe they're the thought of his own death in there. What if he knows all of this? And, you know, bullies people with volume. Well, then his job becomes to teach others. But there are fathers who talk about entertainment, being entertained by your own words. Because, you know, we do have the medieval point of view that everything has an essence and a purpose, which is completely, that's almost the definition of modernity. That concept is rejected. Things are what we want to make of them versus how what they're made for. They even talk about the manipulation of words as a form of usury or fornication, because you're using a created thing for something outside of its purpose, why it was created in the first place. So the loudmouth is both tedious to us and alien to God. It's a waste of mental strength. And if such a person becomes religious, their prayer becomes scattered. It becomes dry, like a plant that doesn't have enough water. The constant talking, the self-expression in a loud and pushy way, in the opinionated way, to, you know, pontificate on pretty much anything that comes up, such a person is incapable of concentrating his thoughts on one thing. He loses the ability to think deeply about much of anything. The way that the Archimandrite describes it is he becomes like a glutton who swallows food without chewing it, or a bell that rings because it's empty inside, and a whole bunch of other metaphors. Words scatter, silence gathers. You know, the Greek Hesychia comes from silent. The hesychastic method, the root of that is silence. It's not just not saying anything. It's an intense focus. Death is something that can only be approached this way, in silence. The loudmouth, the ignoramus, with inexplicable levels of confidence, can live right next to a cemetery, can grow up in front of a funeral home too, or in a funeral home, see coffins carried around every day, and still, it doesn't occur to him that he's going to be there one day. The remembrance of death is prefaced on what the big mouth know-it-all has lost, the ability to contemplate. Almost, he says, it's a way to imprint writing on one's own heart. Speaking, preaching quite a bit, is that's not the problem. It has to do with attitude, and it has to do with completely transgressing your own limits or having no conception of your own limits, because no one has said no to them in the past. The thought of death, like everything critical for salvation, is a gift. Behind the noise of the words that this loudmouth will utter, he can't hear what's really going on in his soul. But for all these guys, death comes very unexpectedly. It's almost as if, and maybe it is, this constant desire to control everything around you. This belief that if I just am able to impose myself on everything in such a way, I won't have to worry about anything. The only person that I could trust, the only person who's competent is me. And in that process is exactly how death is either ignored or seen as something purely hypothetical. He wastes his own time and he wastes our time. And maybe he'll try to out-talk death himself, but he will never have any understanding of what it is or what's going to come afterwards. And then there's a third. Now, he talks about joking. He's not talking about a sense of humor. I actually spent some time on it. What he really means is mockery, building yourself up at someone's expense, falsely. The Proverbs compare that kind of laughter to burning brushwood. Something that produces smoke, but not really a lot of flame and not a lot of warmth. That the pathological reliance on this kind of mockery, dragging everyone down, is, in fact, ultimately, one of the things that distracts him from death. The ridicule, and again, jokes doesn't quite capture, we'll talk about that here in a minute. You notice these all have the same root, and that is this arrogance of control. And if you can't impose yourself on someone in one way or another, the only thing these types have left is mockery. Building yourself up at the expense of whoever it is you're talking about. And the reason this is such a problem, I mean, there's a big difference between making fun of somebody and mocking them. Making fun of someone is something that friends might do. Mockery is malicious. It's just a defamation trying to sound funny. But if man, especially a baptized man, is the image of God, mockery, that mendacious kind of mockery, is presenting him in an ugly form, in a distorted form, very much like a funhouse mirror, depriving him of the dignity of the image of God, and shows him as what he isn't. The cynicism and arrogance that goes with this kind of behavior, yet again a product of pride. One of these people, in other words, he uses a scoffer. He wants to humiliate his neighbor in order to show his imaginary superiority. He says a few things that I haven't heard before. One of the things, and this took some work on my part, one of the synonyms in Russian for the word devil is clown. And it took me a little while, but whether it be the Russian word bes or diavol, they both can be translated as impish. An imp was actually a being. This kind of malicious mockery, this is demonic. When you read about demonic possessions, you'll hear quite a bit about demons mocking humans as being material. He has an obsession with excrement. Something, of course, that demons as a spirit don't have to do. And our deaths, especially under these conditions, are something that he laughs at. So a person who lives this way is imitating the old impish beings. So a science fiction writer may create a totally illusory reality. So the mocker builds a museum of monstrosity, and he invites us to join him. You see him in literature quite often. The soul is in the world. He's holding up a distorted mirror here. And he actually mentions a carnival mirror analogy. And if you didn't know that this is a carnival mirror, you may even think that they're like that. Russian mockery is nasmeshka. And it is the very opposite of reverence. Now, if having a sense of humor is a sin, I'm in a lot of trouble. But that's not what we're talking about here. It also doesn't imply that they're speaking the truth. No, it has to be false, or at least wildly exaggerated. That this kind of behavior, you have the person who wants to control everything, the person who just wants to hear himself talk over everybody else, the know-it-all, and now this sort of person. At that level, they seem to be the same person. And just like all the rest, death is a foreign hypothetical phenomenon. And certainly can't think about ontological questions. Because this habit, this scoffing, whatever you want to call it, nasmeshka, will show the world in a carnival, an absurd, ugly form. In the late Middle Ages, the professional jesters would commemorate the death of those around them using mockery as a symbol. So when they were buried, the funeral procession became a carnival just by itself. In the Gospel of Luke 6:25, God says, "Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall soon mourn and lament." This kind of mendacious laughter brings a person to forget not just about death, but the existence of the demonic world and the danger that his soul is in. This kind of mockery creates insolence. If one of these loudmouths forgets about what's important in life, then there's going to be someone who is ready to imitate it, the wit who's ready to imitate it. There's this, that kind of laughter, and you see this in literature too, this creepy, mysterious element behind it. The old Renaissance concept of the skull, the man laughs at the skull, and the skull laughs back at him. And he uses the example of St. Hesychius. Now, this isn't of Jerusalem. This is Hesychius the Korybite from the 6th century. And that name, Korybite, refers to someone who turns or converts. Someone who converts and then spreads. It's a very odd word. I don't know how many Korybites are in a saint's title. I've not heard it before. But he's of great importance because he passed his life in complete, absolute negligence. He did not pay attention to his soul. He didn't care. He was one of these earlier type of persons. Then he became very, very sick. And for a short time, he died. And when he was, it was for a very brief period of time, and when he came to consciousness, he begged everyone around him to leave. And right there, he built up his monastic cell and stayed in it for 12 years. He did not utter a word to anyone. He lived on bread and water, and as much as humanly possible, he remained motionless. Because of what he had seen, he became completely wrapped in the spirit. He found out the secret of ecstasy. Never changed his manner of life. People thought he was out of his mind, which is not uncommon. Constantly in tears, though. His fellow monks broke open the door when he was about to die. And his last words were, "Forgive me. No one who has acquired the remembrance of death will ever be able to sin." There was this very radical and sudden transfiguration. And it comes from trauma. So this rapid repentance, after coming back from the dead, even after a long period of negligence, he was quickly transformed. It was a traumatic experience rather than what it normally is a lifetime of struggle. No one's quite sure what he saw in that period of time where he was clinically dead, but whatever it was frightened him to the point that he lived that way from then on. For those who refuse to consider death, that is to say, their own death, not death as an abstraction, for such people, the people who we've already described, the control freak, truly believes that he is the only competent one, he's the only smart one, and no one else can be trusted. These people who forget about their own death, death comes to him as an enemy. It comes to him as a terrorizing force, leading him into captivity. The opposite, those who lived as in with remembrance of death, death comes as a friend. Death comes as a liberator from suffering, being brought into the land of eternal peace. In Ecclesiasticus, you have Solomon saying, rush to the house of mourning rather than the house of laughter. Chapter 7, verses 2-4. Although, in the English translations, I don't see the word laughter. The word is feasting. But I think laughter might be extrapolated from that. But there's such a thing as this house of mockery, house of laughter in your own heart. And ultimately, his whole life passes with this absurdity, this aimless absurdity. So whether it be constant worries, whether it be the loudmouth mentality, or whether it be the defamer, these are all demonic creations that hide the reality of their own death from them. Adam, who had forgotten in his innocence about the power of God, tried to actually hide from him in trees, tried to hide from him in the garden, which is, you know, ridiculous. So it's like a child might do. The bargain, the Faustian bargain. In my rushjournal.org, I have a fairly lengthy essay on Dr. Faustus. Faust, by so many, especially writers on our side, typify the modern world. Michael Jones talks about the Faustian bargain concerning usury. In fact, usury is mentioned in that famous story. You read about demonic possessions, possessions that come about because someone has actually made a deal with these dark forces. A person offers his soul to demons because he wants to perpetuate his earthly life. But the devil is a liar. So he'll promise something that there's no way he could ever deliver. Now in the story, Dr. Faustus, there's two conditions for the contract. He signs it with his own blood. Number one, Satan has to give him this pleasure, filling his soul with joy to the point where he doesn't need anything else. He is complete. He is the real definition of perfect. In other words, in need of nothing outside of itself. That's number one. But number two, because he knows that such a state can't last, he requires the demons to be able to stop time. In other words, to imitate what heaven is, not a never-ending march of time, but the elimination of time entirely, the eternal now, which of course Satan has no power to do. He asks that time be stopped, like a river that suddenly turns to ice. Now, these legends are older than Goethe's work. Of course, he was himself a Freemason. And based on these older legends, he created the drama, Rosicrucian mystery, although it's very negative towards the Masonic mentality. Mephistopheles, one of the infernal names, destroys the memory of death by using whatever your most powerful, the hook, whatever your most powerful fantasy happens to be. Because those hooks are how demons communicate with a man, a toy with a man. Faust, in his ignorance, Dr. Faustus didn't realize that demons have no power for any of that. Demons are highly limited. Now, the Protestants, you know, in among their many errors, they believe that these demons are equal in power to God. When in fact, in the book of Job, demons work for God. Demons would love to tell you that they're independent actors, just as strong as the Trinity is. But in reality, even their victories are turned around on them, because their what they think are victories bring about even greater progress for those who understand. The pain that demons rain down on people often is precisely what people need to turn to God. So in the earlier legends, Faust is saying, I want all the pleasure I could possibly handle, and I don't want it to ever end. But every passion, in fact, is opposed to the remembrance of death. That's what passions do. They're images. Because the demonic power is limited, for the most part, unless you actually communicate with them and sign a contract with them, and by that time your heart would be so hardened that repentance is impossible, or almost impossible. In the midst of any kind of passion, whether it be greed or anger, it's this black spot in a sea of white. It's somehow fulfilling one passion after another, one pleasure after another, for them is a sustainable way of living a happy life. Advanced capitalism, its consumerist side, makes exactly that claim. But the ultimate sword, the weapon against demons, are both this remembrance of your own death and prayer that comes directly from it. So long as you remember that, it is very difficult to sin. In other words, every time you sin, something has happened that blocks or short circuits that memory, that you are going to die, and it could be in a few hours for all we know. It's something along the lines of not leaving a house that's on fire or bringing poisonous snakes inside your bed. That's the risk that you're taking. It's really hard to see how anyone can seriously put forth the idea that the pursuit of pleasure is a rational or sustainable life. It's so often the case that the fantasy that we have created in our minds, or have been created for us, these images bear no relation to what it is that they want. And even if they do get it, it's nothing what they thought. And then they get used to it and they want something more. This is not satisfying. You know, Plato makes a big deal about this through his mouthpiece, Socrates, that it doesn't matter how much satisfaction you get. There's a whole bunch of other unsatisfied passions coming right behind it. But it is, he mentions the Faustus legends, eventually collected in that book. Of course, it was far more complicated than the book itself. And if you look at my article on it, it's far more. There was financial elements, usurious elements. But the earlier legends are much simpler. That's what people who pursue this life are actually saying. The only way that the pursuit of pleasure, satisfying passions, whatever passions are the strongest, as Thomas Hobbes would say, the only way that's sustainable is if it never changes. Once it's satisfied and the pleasure is upon you, that somehow you figure out a way to intensify it and to keep it going, at least for the rest of your life. But the heart has to believe in this nonsense to live this life. And people live it not even out of a conscious choice, but because they don't know anything else. He makes the statement that all human life, the rational human life, is this constant collapse of illusions. Human life, if pursued properly, is just one illusion and one fantasy falling apart and using your reason to unveil it, leaving the truth underneath. The collapse of illusions is a lesson that people learn but don't want to remember. Illusions are easy. They're comfortable. They're the stock and trade of the loudmouth and the ignoramus and the control freak. Of course, Satan can't stop time, but he may hint that he might be able to. He himself awaits the last judgment. These fantasies can and do take away this fear, although not terror, of death. And somehow we believe that we have confidence in this earthly existence, which will never end. He mentions a 19th century sect. I think he's referring to the Christian Sciences. It's conceivable he was talking about the more radical Shakers, He doesn't name them, but he says there's a strange sect whose members truly believe that they're going to live on Earth forever. I think it's Christian Science because of their point of view of disease. People die, and or the more extreme version of this, you know, Eddie's 1875 book. People die because they believe in their death. You will not die if you reject the concept of death. Now, they die all the time. It doesn't change anything. As Jehovah's Witnesses had talked about Armageddon from the 19th century onward. And every date that they put out there, it comes and goes, and no one seems to get it. What they'll say, they have, you know, a whole list of excuses. So for these people, the more radical Christian Scientists, I think, Shakers, whatever, that when these people start dying, it's because they had a lack of faith. They wavered in their belief. There is no death, and they admitted that fact. And they were punished for their doubt. We won't make that mistake. The 19th century sect, he says, where it clearly arose, America, and it still exists. They believe that they will never die if they have the proper mindset, that death is an illusion that comes into existence because you believe in it. Now, he mentions this because he says, we think the same thing. If we're truly honest that this idea exists in many of our minds, that somehow we think that death is going to miss us, because it's purely a hypothetical reality, and somehow we will be hidden from death in some kind of a reincarnation where consciousness doesn't change. But what is the mindset? The rational mind says, I will die. God's providence, even before the creation of the world, had my grave dug. And that's where my body will remain until the last judgment. But it's very hard to stop there. No, the mind also, sir, retorts, this is just too terrible to be true. You see this in the prayers of St. John Chrysostom, where he says, grant me the remembrance of death and fervent prayer, which is born from the remembrance of death in the heart. In other words, this is something we have to ask for because it's extremely unpleasant. You know, there's a million ways for people to die. There's an icon, and he mentions this too. St. Macarius the Great, who died in 391 AD, St. Macarius of the Desert. And one of his icons, especially in the Middle Ages in Greece and Russia, it's a reflection on why these people ended up in the desert, especially St. Anthony in the tombs. So many of their initial hermits were in tombs. And his icon, you could see the pyramids in the background. These tombstones, or so we're told, over the graves of the pharaoh. And he's depicted as sitting on a stone near the cave, you know, the cells dug into a cave. And in front of him are human bones. And then there's a shovel and sometimes a pickaxe there. It's unclear if the tools belong to him. He wants to bury them. But either way, St. Macarius is immersed in reflection about the transience of our life. And behind him, you see a traditional depiction of death. This black figure in a scythe. It's not just a scythe, though, also the hourglass. The hourglass is very obvious that there's a fixed amount of time that we're given. And of course, the scythe, because it's a harvesting tool, we will be cut down, as the New Testament says. Next to him is an angel with a scroll that says, Macarius, hasten to do God's will. There's a lot of variations of this icon. Sometimes it's at night. Sometimes it's a sunny day. And either way, the desert was chosen because it is an image of death, the lack of life. And when it's depicted at night, there's different versions of this. Moonlight is depicted falling on the bones and the skull, as if to highlight them. And in many of these, you can see the pyramids, these kind of buildings, at the edge of the Herat, barely, you can barely see them. And right in between is the cell of St. Macarius. And these bones are in front of him, and I don't think he wants to bury them. I think he wants to keep them there. The remains are there so that the noise of the world doesn't creep into any corner of his soul. It does not, the world cannot distract him from what he's there, to tear him away from prayer. The world has laid out its nets for us. But both prayer and remembrance of death are the two wings, so to speak, that we use to overcome it. There's also an article by St. Ignatius, Brian Chaninoff, who I've dealt with this year, actually, called The Brevity of Life. If this is in English, I don't know. I haven't seen it in English. And he's talking about himself in solitude. Again, silence, true silence, without distraction, is essential here. And he's talking about the nature of the desert dweller, even if it's not literally in a desert. And he relates when he was in contemplation, that he was granted a flash of insight that life was very, very short, that the overwhelming majority of his life has passed, and that the future is very, very short. He says that he doesn't see anything new in the world. The same virtues, the same vices, the same passions that approach him 20 years ago as it does at this moment. The same reality that the virtuous will always be among us. They'll either be unnoticed or persecuted. And in the same way, vice, hiding behind its various pretexts and masks, will deceive and then dominate the world. Whether you live for 2 years or 100 years, relative to eternity, of course, they're both equally small and insignificant. That's actually a literal truth next to eternity. He notes something that I've mentioned many times, that people think of the future as this one long march of time, and when compared to the past, is inconceivable. But no, instead, eternity is this eternal now. And he says solitude brings some of this, not being alone necessarily, but in solitude, with true, honest introspection, which is a very rare talent, can bring these same flashes of insight. The path to eternity, as he would say, is the narrow one. There are no side quests here. It has to be completed with the mind and the heart, not in the number of days or years. The mind illuminated by the understanding of the truth can preserve the heart in its goodness and in patience. What the new man, what the baptized man is, the ascetic is supposed to become, that's what the desert is. That's what monasteries are for. That's the nature of holy reading. It's what confession is for. We are obligated to live this way, although especially in 20... St. Ignatius was living in a utopia by comparison to what we have. Pagan Rome was utopia compared to what we have. We're in a far weaker position than anyone centuries ago. Ignatius was writing in the 19th century. He says, if you can't live completely like this, now remember, he's writing mostly to monks. He says, at least live partly like this. And you won't have any choice anyway. Because your shortcomings, once you're honest about them, can be healed by your own self-condemnation and repentance and labor. Seeing shortcomings, and as you progress in the spirit, they'll become even sharper in your mind. They remind you of your limits. They remind you to be humble. And the ultimate shortcoming is that you're going to die. And it doesn't matter how long it is. The mentality has to be the same. How many generations have come and gone? The overwhelming majority of these people long forgotten, like they were never there. At any given moment, the generation we're a part of is already being replaced by another, being pushed out as we get older. There's a difference, in fact, the confrontation between solitude on the one hand and the restless world on the other. The only occupation, I mean, you know, in the very short lifespan, occupations are necessary and needful. But the as the book many of you are familiar with, The One Thing Needful, says, being on the path is far more important than any of them. The gospel is a port, he says, where the Mother of God can find shelter for the nativity. Same thing for a faithful soul approaching repentance, outside of the city, outside of love for the world, outside of its noise. St. Ignatius Brianchaninov also has a brief article called On Mourning. And this, I think we have covered in the past, if not, maybe not directly, but holiness comes from suffering through temptation and pain. It comes down to acceptance. This is the very opposite of the person who has to control everything, that cares about everything, that's imposing himself on everything. Tribulations, suffering, this has been a sign of God's election. St. Basil said, and I repeat this so many times, that these evil people who you see doing so well, that is evidence that God has abandoned them. Sufferings are a sign of pleasing God for everyone from the patriarchs on up. Temptation, sorrow, using patience, and certainly the remembrance of death, this is how they became saints in the first place. We are allowed various misfortunes. And the key sentence is that nothing happens to any of us without the permission of God. There are no autonomous forces. To become deified one day, the key element is enduring in patience, bodily suffering, insults, slander, and our own passions, all of that. And that's where trust in God's will comes from. Hence, that's where humility comes from, because one can't function without the other. To avoid being plunged into despondency and not, you know, depression, not clinical depression, this belief that I'm just not worth it, this abulia that I've spoken of so many times, Michael Hoffman speaks of so many times. And St. Ignatius talks about the fact that God is not, will never permit you to be tempted beyond your means. But it's not just that. It's that within these sufferings, there'll be an abundance of opportunities for deliverance, for holiness. The devil is a unwilling servant of God. He is created just like we are. He embitters us only to the extent that God allows it, while keeping them thinking that they're autonomous and just as strong as God is. God knows exactly what we can handle. Without suffering, we don't know anything. It's like a young person is incapable of performing in the world. He can't manage a household. He can't cultivate land. He hasn't mastered a craft yet. He's too young. Very much like somebody who may have been baptized, but without the sorrows that most of us go through, he is an infant trying to hold down a job. This is for our benefit. The assumption that suffering is automatically a bad thing that should be avoided is strictly a postmodern one. As it's going on, of course, we hate it. But once it's over, we realize just how important it is. We wouldn't care about any of this stuff if death wasn't in front of us, if it wasn't happening all the time, if relationships are broken and severed. Martyrs were martyrs because they suffered. This is, of course, we're not talking about society. We're talking about their personal struggles. And the more difficult their feat, the more glory they gain. The path leading to salvation is difficult. That's not an accident. Don't shy away from these sufferings. Don't try to control everything so you don't suffer, so nothing bad happens. And as St. Paul says, whatever suffering we may be going through at the moment is nothing compared to what God promises in the gospel. Our sufferings mean nothing. And in fact, they don't. Only the secular person sees them as an unmitigated evil. They suffer for no reason. Demons are always using these sufferings to steer us away from, among other things, the remembrance of death. We reject grumbling, complaining, sadness. And we suffer with those far more than the actual sorrow itself. Personal revenge is out of the question. He says, mortify yourself every day by abstaining from sinful desires. Reject your own will. And he goes even farther. Further, he says, our sorrows are difficult because we are not willing to die. We're not willing to become martyrs. We don't want to stop our trust in the world, our wealth, our minds. We will not leave it to God alone. To be a zealous imitator of his sufferings is key. And that becomes easier when you remember that you are going to die. The last thing I want to mention, and I've done this before too, maybe not just in this section, but St. John Climacus, step 6 in his ladder of divine ascent is to remember death, the remembrance of death. And he says, remembrance of death is what precedes weeping and mourning, because every word is preceded by a thought. Now, fear of death is natural. There's no getting out of that. And this is where the distinction between fear and terror is made. Fear is just a matter of respect. You say, fear God. That phrase, especially in Old English, refers to being in awe of something. Terror is a different story. If you are terrorized by the thought of death, it means that there's something that you haven't repented of yet. Even Christ feared death in the garden in that sense, but he never showed any terror. And like we've said before in section 6, for those who are free of the noise of this world, the remembrance of death is precisely that which puts aside these kind of daily cares and brings about the guarding of the mind and constant prayer. Somebody who wants to retain this memory and from that build prayer, salutary judgment, love of God, and at the same time is one of the people we've mentioned, yields to these material cares and distractions. He says it's like a man who is swimming who wants to clap his hands. It doesn't make any sense. Perfect love is free from failure. So a perfect understanding of our future death is also free from fear. Fear is not terror. Fear is respect. The person who has died to all things is the one who remembers death. And he says, for those who are still tied to the world, he does nothing but plot against himself. And he goes so far in step 6, section 24. It is impossible to be devout. It's impossible to spend today, the present day, devoutly, unless we assume it's the last day of our life. Repentance, compunction, this kind of growth, this is impossible without the realization that we will die and then go to the judgment. Holy people fear death in the sense of respect and stand in front of it with awe. Unrepentant sinners are terrified of it. I've mentioned the cryogenic movement before as this awful fear. Abba Dorotheos of Gaza says that upon our death, we will remember every unrepentant sin that we have committed, just in this case, without any justification or mystification. It's the idea that at death, all of our hidden sins will come flooding back to us in its raw form, without our dishonest explanations, without our deception. Just raw is the beginning of repentance. If you remember the hour of our repose that's coming up, the judgment seat, that inspires repentance. hence rejection from the pursuits of the world. Because everything accomplished in the world is tainted with death. That first start in the garden. Everything tends to decay. Building is difficult, but destruction is easy. Inertia. Everything resists us all the time. Learning is difficult, but forgetting, it's just an easy matter of time. Getting fat and out of shape is very easy. The opposite takes a lot of work. Everything resists us. This is how, you know, entropy is built into the system. St. Gregory Palama says, repentance is the beginning, middle, and end of our life. This is why you can't get through an Orthodox service without the remembrance of death being mentioned several times. It's one thing to accept it, and none of us are innocent here. It's one thing to accept it intellectually, but to make it a part of your will, to place it etched in our hearts, is a totally different story. Yes, we know abstractly that we can die here in a few minutes, but it's our own pride that prevents us from seeing this. The remembrance of death that doesn't lead to this terrible despondency is a gift. We find this existential fear. All the existentialists worried about this. That death puts a limit on everything. And there's a few ways to deal with it. One way is simply to treat it as abstract. It's just inevitable. It's a fact of nature. It's insignificant. Don't worry about it. If that's the position you take, then God's love is irrelevant. Everything will be extinguished and everything ends with our own decay. There's another way. This deep yearning that there is something greater than anything material that we have to work for. That's what creates a rational life. It lays out our purpose. Understanding that, we would reject every kind of pleasurable, no matter how long it would last, because it's nothing compared to being with God through grace at the end of all things. You don't blame God for things. You don't blame God for misery because that's a part of the struggle. We don't believe in purgatory because purgatory is now. You're in the middle of it. That's the point. Not just physical suffering, but spiritual, psychological suffering too. If that's taken and brought to a life of prayer, that makes the suffering worthwhile. That makes the suffering even a good thing. Because unless there's a resurrection, the very existence of death renders everything we do is absolutely absurd. About 30 years ago, a friend of the family killed himself. We buried him, of course, over the funeral home. And at the time, I mean, as the years went by, I knew him. As years went by, I realized something. I could say this today. This is what, you know, almost 40 years later. If he didn't do that, and he was still alive, whatever it was that caused him to be that miserable, to shoot himself, would be gone. He wouldn't even remember it. The things that you think are so important in the moment, in 20, 30, 40 years, will have no relevance. You won't remember it. This is what growing up in cemeteries and around dead bodies forces. I had no choice in the matter. It used to be that people took trips to cemeteries. That's why they're called memorial parks. People had picnics there. They were with the family members who were gone. You don't, no one does that anymore. Cemeteries are going out of style. It's very expensive and all the rest of it, but people are so shielded from death and are being told that maybe death could be conquered. This is John Rockefeller. I forget how many. I think he had 10 heart transplants. Because, of course, he's a unlimited well. That's terror. That's the absolute terrifying fear of death. But the rejection of that is an illusion. And that's what life is. It's the constant conquest of the illusions that are thrown up against us. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.